Hi, everybody. How are you today? Happy Friday. Hope it's fun. Hope it's fantastic. Hope it's filled with frivolities. I could go on and on, but I won't. Welcome back to the podcast. I am Mark Ciaccardini. So let's get right into it. We are thrilled to speak to our next guest, composer extraordinaire Joshua Klebe, who has worked on some of the most amazing and iconic films in the last 10 years. Captain Phillips, he had a small role in. He worked on Rango. He's been working since the age of five, if you can believe it or not. But we are excited to have him come to the stage to talk about himself. So, Joshua, please, how's things in your world?
They are good. They are busy, as always, it seems, and constantly locked in my studio writing music. So, no, it's been good. Okay. Thank you for having me.
No problem. They say the life of a composer tends to be siloed, and, you know, even these days things become more remote. I mean, do you pull your hair out trying to get a cue done and not working with people directly? How do you work? I mean, you have great hair, by the way, so maybe you're not pulling it out.
No, I still pull it out. it can be a bit of a lonely job at times. You're definitely in your dark room, trying to come up with ideas musically and things. I always like to get outside every once in a while and get some fresh air. I think it's important to remove yourself from the studio to keep yourself creative, because we're only as creative as what we know, and you don't know anything if you don't go out and see the world. So I think it's important to find that balance there as much as you possibly can. But yeah, it's, you know, once you're in the middle of a project, I'm fully engulfed in the story itself and living, breathing it. It's the first thing that's going to be I'm thinking about when I'm waking up. And I think that just helps myself be the most creative I can within that world and make sure I really feel like the musical identity of the show is fully ingrained in the story.
Well, you've done a lot of work on properties that include Aliens from Krypton, Talking Lizards, Indianapolis Speed Drivers, even the planet itself, Blue Planet 2. So I know this is a bit granular to get into the beginning of the interview, but when you start writing something, how do you view or how do you process what you're seeing? Do you write for a character? Do you write for a theme? Do you write for the mood that you have inside? What are some of your first steps?
I usually like to start off with either there's some sort of preemptive footage that's been sent to me, or there's just a script itself. And I don't even want to touch a keyboard, sit at my piano or anything until I've just had time to kind of sit with the story and really think about what this story could sound like for the audience. And I don't like to rush it as much as possible. It could be anything from a instrument idea comes to mind, or a color itself, or just a feeling. And from there, then I'll allow myself to sit in front of my computers and my keyboard and start just exploring ideas. I always like to find writing a suite of music kind of just freely and not worrying too much about what notes I'm putting down is the best way to really get the creative juices flowing and really start to discover what new unique thing you could do for the show. And it could be exploring a specific character's theme. It could be exploring just an overall universal theme for the entire film or series itself. I feel like I try to like pinpoint what could be the most important aspect to that story and let that be my starting point and grow from there, and build kind of some building blocks that, you know, can lead to the next thing. But it really is just starting from anything that is sparks my imagination with it. And then from there, just trying things and playing. I mean, really at the end of the day, you're writing music. It doesn't have to be serious. It can be fun. It can be enjoyable. It can be playful. It can be, it's really about just enjoying what you're doing in that moment to, I think, be the most creative you can with the story.
Well, I'd say that from the smile, it's clear that you enjoy what you do, but as any creative will probably tell you, there's a tinge of terror right behind your teeth. Like, how am I going to get this done? Is this right? Am I, you know, imposter syndrome, you know, like what's the director going to think? But I think that, you know, as long as you are happy with it and, you know, it comes from the inside, that's really the best you can do. And,
oh, there's the screaming and the crying and all of it amongst all of that. And then you reach the other side of it. It's the pain first.
I guess it's good you've got those drapes. Are they soundproof? You just go behind and go.
yes, absolutely.
Well, you know, I talked to Michael Giacchino a long time ago, and I asked him a kind of grapefruit question. I said, when you start or when you're working on something, do you take a macro or micro approach? And he says macro. He likes to go big world and go in. And even though I'm not in music, I'm in architecture actually. And so sometimes what I do is I try to build something out from something small. And I don't think that there's a wrong way to do it, but I think where he was going with it, it's like you got to get your grip around everything, and then you can find little, you know, like pieces will fall into place where, you know, like to quote Keegan-Michael Key, he said that improv is like walking backwards. And the more you see in your periphery, the more you're able to pick off and put into what you're doing. So does music work the same way?
Absolutely. I think when you're writing music for film and television, at its core, you're serving a purpose. You're serving the story itself that's on the screen. And that's, you always have to remind yourself of that. You're not writing music to be your standalone thing. And so it's important to understand the entire concept of the story, to really have those conversations with the creative team, the directors, the producers early on, so you really understand what the whole arc of the story is and where you need to go. And I think that's, for me, I always need to look at that first, and then I can go in from there and go, okay, how do I get from point A to point B at the end? You know, what can help me get there? And then I go into the finer details to kind of start putting together a sound that could tell that full story. So I definitely think that, you know, it's like I said, at the end of the day, you're serving a purpose, you're serving the film itself. And so you need to, that should be your main focus in all of it.
Sure. Well, let's go in the way back machine, if we can. Let's go to a 5-year-old you who, I was floored to read this fact. You were singing at your grandparents' opera house. That alone is a story and a book and a movie all in itself. So can you go back that far? What details, please? Joshua,
yes. So my grandparents owned an opera house in my hometown, Petaluma, California. It's called Cinnabar Theater. It's still there. My grandpa's passed away since then, but my grandma's still there and keeping it going. And it was a old schoolhouse that they had turned into a more intimate opera house. My grandpa sang in Paris and San Francisco and was part of kind of the bigger opera houses. And he just wasn't a fan of how they were being run in the aspect of how the performers were being treated, kind of the grueling hours that were involved, and also just the inaccessibility that opera seems to have in this, you know, more in the States itself. It's tickets are expensive. It's quite, you know, it can be seen in a different light than, you know, going to see, I don't know, even a musical itself. And so they were hoping to bring opera to a more smaller, intimate audience and make it more accessible, have tickets be $30, $40 to go, but still bring the same quality that a San Francisco Opera House had. So they would get a lot of performers from San Francisco Opera House and things like that. And so that was essentially, when I go to grandma's house, it was going to a stage and costumes and running around and playing with the lights and doing all of that. So by the age of 5, I was in Madame Butterfly with my grandpa. And I did several operas after that. I was in Falstaff. And it was a lot of fun. I don't know if I ever considered myself a singer, but I became far more interested in the musicians that were off stage. And so I started taking piano lessons. I want to say it was 7 or 8 at that time. My sister was also taking piano lessons with me, so we do duets and things. Oh, and wow. From there, I studied piano for about 13, 14 years, classical piano. I realized early on I was not a fan of Bach. I liked the themes that were far more emotional, where I didn't have to be so regimented in time. And then that kind of led to, oh, I can kind of just write my own things. That feels more fun. But kind of in conjunction with that, I was a competitive gymnast for 13 years. And I was also doing fine art. And I kind of originally thought I was going to pursue just fine art. So those kind of all collided with my love for body movement, my love for visuals. And so when I realized that scoring for film and television was an occupation, that seemed like a natural fit for me. So then I found my way to Los Angeles and began that journey.
Well, if I heard right, that was 14 years of piano lessons and 12 years as a competitive gymnast?
13 That's years of competitive gymnast, yeah. Okay. And I also coached as well.
That's a lot of years for just one hobby. And you've had, you know, like the trifecta of all these, you know, artistic expressions and things. I've never played piano, but I can't imagine, or I guess the question I have for you is, at what point did you, you know, playing classical or taking these lessons, what point were you able to start to not just interpret, but, you know, find your groove, find what was, you know, your creative leaning that helped you write?
I was just drawn to how it made me feel emotionally. I just enjoyed the emotional impact it would have on me, of feeling like I could look at something on a page and play it with my fingers and bring out something that felt emotional. And that's, from there, it's just, you kind of become addicted to it. And you just want to find other ways to feel that musically. And so I think it felt like a natural progression for me at that point, that here I could read these notes on a page and I can play it out, and it was enjoyable. What happens if I put my own notes on the page? What happens if I want to express my own feelings at that point? And so that's, I can't tell you if I remember the exact age I was in feeling that. It just kind of, from the moment I started playing, I felt something. And so I wanted to keep doing it.
Gotcha. I think I know how you feel in some respect, because I was watching Top Gun Maverick. I've seen it twice this year. And there's a part where Miles Teller sits down as Goose's son and starts playing Great Balls of Fire. But before he gets into it, he does this little jazz number. And, you know, he's got the glasses on, and it just gives you these tingles. So I can only imagine what it's like as someone listening to it versus somebody actually playing it and getting those, you know, just, it comes from you and you're able to do what you did. So I think I know what you mean.
If you can feel something, yes, exactly.
Well then, you know, so what happened when you got to Los Angeles? What was the temperature of the time? Who were some of the first people you reached out to and started working with?
So I went to Los Angeles in 2009. I just finished my sophomore year in college. I was at Sonoma State University. And this is where kind of my two worlds crossed. I was a gymnastics coach, and I was coaching a kid whose parents had worked with the composer Hans Zimmer 13 years prior in his studio. And so they had found out that I was interested in film scoring and things. And so they made a phone call to get me in there as an internship. So that's why I went to LA to go do this internship. And that lasted for the month or however long it was. And then from there, I kind of just stayed. And they were willing to hire me on and be kind of just a runner assistant in the studio. You're doing, you know, kind of the grunt work, you know, anything and everything, just from studio cleanup to, you know, preparing meals, whatever it may be amongst the studio. And that took me, so obviously I dropped out of college at that point. I when I was there, I saw that there were people that were coming, students that were coming from schools like USC and things that I would have loved to have gone to, that have an amazing film scoring program, but they were still starting where I was starting. So at that point I thought, all right, well, I have years of piano experience. I kind of just have math classes left and things like that. Let's just see where this can go. I don't know anyone else in the industry, and this, I want to, you know, take this as much as I can. So stuck it out for another 2 years, 2.5 years of being a runner assistant. At that point, Hans gave me the opportunity to do some arrangements for the Oscars that he was the musical director for that year. And then that kind of role just kept being larger and larger, in the sense that I then was playing piano at the show and I was kind of doing almost the majority of all the mock-ups, which was really exciting and fun. And I impressed him enough with that set that he then gave me a room and I began writing on his films. And that lasted for a while and was intense and grueling, but an amazing experience. And you're learning from, obviously, one of the best in the industry. And so that is kind of what then set me up in that capacity.
Wow. So you actually played piano in the pit at the 84th Annual Academy Awards? You were...
Yes.
Phenomenal. That is incredible. What was the energy? Because, like, I, you know, unfortunately, we've heard this year they cut the best film score and anything relating to music from the awards. And then I talked to William Ross a couple of years ago when he put on the award ceremony, and there's no pit. They do it off, you know, in a different building. So it's so unfortunate that we're... Anyway, so go back to that. So the big night, and you're there. Like, what was it like? What do you still remember anything?
I mean, you know, in true Hans fashion, of course, it was going to, you know, he was going to make it a musical spectacle moment, which was great. And I mean, this is, thank goodness for all my years of piano experience, because leading up to that, you would do some pre-records. And there was a moment when Hans just said, well, go out in the room and record this piano part. And I was just sight reading and made it through. And he even said, he's like, well, thank goodness all those piano studying years. Thank your parents. I'm like, yes. I mean, it was an amazing experience. I sat in the pit. I stared at Meryl Streep all night while playing. I can't remember how old I was at that point. It was wild. This is Los Angeles. This is an experience. So.
Well, I heard that, now granted that the vehicle was Trevor Noah. Trevor Noah said this about Nelson Mandela, so I don't quite know if it's true, but it's hysterical. He said that Nelson Mandela said, that's how you know you've made it, when you can print your own money. So as somebody who runs a country, has just, you know, that amazing control, I guess in the film music world, that's how you know you've made it, when you work with Hans Zimmer. So going from the internship to, you know, getting your own room, what was your first assignment? And I guess how much, what was it at that time? Was it remote control?
Yes, it was remote control. And the first film I wrote on was Dark Knight Rises.
Ooh, nice.
And so that was I had seen The Dark Knight probably 10 times in the movie theater. So to be able to write music on the next one was just a surreal experience. You kind of just get thrown in the deep end and you either sink or swim at that point. And I stayed afloat and worked on that. I worked on Rango, worked on Man of Steel, worked on Captain Phillips briefly, worked on Rush. They're long hours. But it's a very collaborative process. You're amongst a bunch of other composers that are working on the film. And I think the most valuable thing I took away from it was just being able to be in the room with Hans when he's in front of a director. Because I think that's a huge part of this industry that people don't quite realize, is it's, yes, there's the act of writing the music and, you know, coming up with that concept. However, you have to be friendly. You have to know how to talk to a director. You have to know how to understand a story, how to interpret what someone is saying to you and apply that musically. And you're going to be getting notes that are not musical terms. So translating something that's an emotional term or a story plot point, you need to be able to find ways to convey that. And Hans is, I mean, the master at that. He really understands, you know, kind of going back to what I said earlier, that the music is serving a purpose. It's serving the story and making sure that your music is absolutely telling that story audibly as best as you possibly can. And finding ways to connect things, you know, knowing when to bring back a certain theme, knowing when to, you know, nod to another character in a creative way. And so that was definitely the biggest takeaway I got from working with Hans in that capacity. And so then from there, I went to the company next door called Bleeding Fingers Music, which is kind of the television department. And I kind of get your own room. You get a little more freedom at that point to kind of start stretching your own composing wings as far as finding your own voice, which I think is the very difficult part in this industry, is finding what's going to make you stand out, what's going to make people come to you to do your scores, what's, you know, what gives you your musical identity. If you think about all the other composers in this industry, they all have a sound that is very distinct and that is, you know, people love it. And so finding your own voice is important. And so Bleeding Fingers gave me that space to be able to do that and start to kind of really discover what could be my sound or what, you know, what interests me or what I, you know, to try new things. And so from there, that's where I worked on this series Planeter 2 and Blue Planet 2 and kind of a slew of other television projects.
Well, what you said there in the efforts to find your own sound, I imagine that with TV, just because it's there are multiple episodes, and like you were saying before, knowing when to call back to a theme or a character, I mean, you can stretch this out over over a bigger canvas, so to speak. Although with Blue Planet 2, there are different episodes, you know, like Green Seas or Coasts or something, like you don't exactly, some of that stuff could be like compartmentalized. This episode is its own thing. This thing is its own thing. So how did you find yourself trying to find your music or find your thing, but then have completely different themes?
I think it's about applying a certain aesthetic to whatever show you're working on or film you're working on. I think, for me, you know, again, going back to what I said earlier, the emotional aspect of music is what really draws me to it. And so I think for me, my strength is finding the emotional core of scenes and really pulling that emotion out melodically. And I think that's is a strength of mine that I always try to bring to every project in any capacity. And also, I think just finding a unique sound. Like I really like finding different weird sounds, instruments. I don't like to use anything too conventional if I can help it. You know, there's always the bass of piano and strings and whatnot. Like with this last project I just worked on, Queer as Folk, it was like, you know, taking anything and everything can be an instrument. And that is, I think, what is exciting for me and what I think helps make me have my sound is, you know, so for something like a Planet Earth 2, although each episode was its own, had its own individual sound aspect to it, there was a cohesiveness across it through the use of like a main theme or just kind of the overall aesthetic approach of using these more natural sounds that could be found in the environment and mixing that with orchestra.
I would really want to go into Queer as Folk, but I have two questions about your time at Remote Control and Bleeding Fingers. One is more of a technical question, I guess. You know, the composers are siloed. Is Remote Control just a bunch of tiny rooms, or have they adopted, like, you know, most workstations and workplaces go like an open air environment, which I think would be catastrophic when you're trying to record or do music. But what's it like, and then how are you able to interact with people?
You do need your separate rooms because you need the soundproofing. You need to be able to hear your own music in that way. So you couldn't necessarily do an open-ended thing in that way. But then we would all kind of congregate into, for like Remote Control, you would congregate into Hans's room and we would play things back and we would listen and Hans would give feedback and we would discuss things. Was for something like Bleeding Fingers, kind of a similar idea. You kind of just go visit people's studios. Everyone was kind of, there was, you know, the doors were open for people to want to like walk in. When I did Planet Earth 2, I worked with the composer Jacob Shea. And so we were very much, we were just down the hall. So we'd go back and forth and compare ideas and talk about things. And we'd have meetings almost every other morning just to discuss where we're at and like, you know, just overall visions for things. So I, you know, unlike, you know, if you work at home as I do now and things, there's obviously not a composer down the way. I mean, I can talk to my cats and ask them what they think, you know, but it's a little different.
Are they usually very positive? I know cats have a mean streak.
No, they're terrible.
Worst critics right ever. Well, just last question about that is, so sometimes when someone gets a role as an uncredited contributor to the score or additional music, and not to say that their work is not valuable, but you know, it takes a village to make you know, to make a score. So at what point is it a quantity of time that somebody like, I guess, how much, when somebody reads the credit that says additional music, how many minutes does that usually tend to work out to be? Or is it vary by project?
This is an interesting question within our industry about how this all works. And there's a lot of factors that come into play with this. Yes, like there, it takes a village to do these scores. You know, sometimes you can just do it on your own and that's, you know, but there's oftentimes what you battle as a composer is simply just time. There's what's kind of strange about working on these projects is very little do they consult with their composer about an actual time that's needed to do the score. You're kind of given, here's the production schedule, here's the delivery dates. And you kind of just have to meet that. And sometimes those delivery dates are just impossible. And so you have to bring people in because you have to, just to get it across the finish line in time. And so that plays a role into bringing people in. You know, budgets plays a factor. Unfortunately, budgets aren't great at times on projects. And there's, because of technology, you can get away with hiring less musicians. Which I just don't like. I feel like, you know, you're going to get a much different product if you can bring the live musicians in. But sometimes the budget is not there. And so then you are, you know, and so then when there's budget constraints and things, at the end of the day, this is how you make a living. You have to take on more work in order to achieve, you know, just paying your bills. And so then there, you might have multiple projects going on at that time. And then when you have multiple projects and multiple deadlines, then you need more help in order to get it done. When it comes to how much someone contributes on a project, it varies. I mean, I, having been on the other end of things and seeing how that can work, I mean, I think it's just always important to credit everyone as much as you possibly can. You know, ultimately, additional music for someone who's doing the additional music on that show and you're early on in your career is like one of the most exciting things, to be able to see your name show up on that screen. And I think, you know, it's these little confidence boosters that keeps you kind of going through this tough industry. And I think that that's always important to make sure that people feel recognized in that way for the work that they do. And, you know, and then on that side of it, there's also just things beyond your control. Sometimes simply a production company tells you, no, you can't have that credit. You can't, we're only giving you one credit because I don't quite understand why always, but they may just say, no, your music team, you can only have the composing credit. And so that also plays a factor into why a credit might show up on a screen or why it might not show up on a screen. So there's lots of factors that come involved in this.
I remember, you know, I spoke to Christopher Leonard's a long time ago, and he was telling me kind of like, not the math that it takes to, like I said, what goes into 1 minute of music? And so he was telling me, in a more or less perfect world, one person could do about 5 minutes of music a week, I think he said, or maybe 5 minutes of music a day. I forget exactly what it was. But yes, some movies are wall-to-wall music, and movies these days are easily over 2 hours. So yeah, I could see how everybody needs to come together. But it's just so unfortunate to hear, you know, that budgets are crap, because you know, music is such a important part of the narrative canvas that it's like, hey man, can I get $50 more to get this bugle that I need? It's gonna make the scene. And like, to hear no, that's just, as a fan, that's frustrating. But I, you know, as a creative, I could see that that's just devastating. But art through adversity, I guess.
Yeah, it's frustrating. I mean, at times it can be an advantage. I don't want to say an advantage. At times it challenges you to be creative, knowing that, no, I actually won't be able to go record that. So how else can I look at the score with the budget confinements that I have to achieve something? And sometimes you end up creating something that you wouldn't have normally created, and it's exciting and different. So, but we still get paid. I think what happens is, composers used to receive a majority of their income from royalties and backend. And that has become an issue now with streaming services, because that backend has significantly essentially disappeared. So it used to be, here's kind of your fee, your package deal, and you can go spend it on the musicians and all the things to make the score, but you kind of knew backend's going to come in to kind of help recoup those costs and then kind of pay for my time in that way. Unfortunately, now with those backends having gone down, the budgets haven't gone up though to compensate that. And so it's you have to become a business person. You have to like recognize can you afford to record and how much can you record given the budget you have, and mix and orchestrate and all of, you know, and bring on additional help and all the things to get the score across while still making sure you can pay your bills.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the big losses to the film score community was James Horner, who died tragically in a plane crash. I wish I could have spoken to him, because of all the brilliant things he's done and contributed and just, you know, basically crafted my experience as a kid and a film score fan. There was a part in The Amazing Spider-Man 1 where he literally lifted 8 or 9 bars from The Rocketeer. And I would just like to know, was that a, did that really mean that much to the movie to have that little motif? Was that a time constraint thing? Was it you couldn't get a horn player, so this was the closest? I would just love to know those creative decisions that result in what we hear as a consumer. We'll never know the answer to that. Maybe Mark Webb knows, but I'll suffice to say, when you talk about giving credit to people, I, you know, one of the movies that I saw recently, which I saw a lot more focus on who makes the music, was Ridley Scott's The Last Duel. Score was composed by Harry Gregson Williams. And I just saw a slew of credits listing out members of the orchestra, people who played certain instruments, where that I've not seen that too regularly. So is that a way that people are, you know, are musicians getting more their due these days instead of additional composers?
I think it's important to do that. I definitely try to do that whenever I can. I did a Netflix series, Animal, and I made a point to try to get every musician that was involved listed. You get a little pushback sometimes, but you can push back at them and say, no, include them. It's funny when you look at these credits, I think people forget about just how many people involved who make one film or a TV show, and the credits you're seeing, you know, everyone's not on there. So when there's these really long credits and this like, you know, end credits thing, it's, you know, that's how many, it takes so many people to pull these things off. And everyone should be there. Everyone should be able to have their name on the screen in that capacity. And it should just serve as a reminder that while you may see, you know, a head figure's name on that, just understanding that they aren't alone doing it. And that's okay. I mean, that's fine. Like, I feel like maybe there's a stigma that it's not okay that they're not the only person doing it, but I mean, it's that's just what this industry is. It can be a collaborative process in that way, and it should be celebrated.
Yeah, everyone from craft services to now COVID protocol engineers, or I'm not sure what the title is, but that's something you have to be part of. But well, why don't we just take a quick detour? Stephen Dunn created this Queer as Folk, this episode, this season that came out this year, centers on a group of club-going friends who find support in the gay community following a tragedy. So how did you get involved? The discussions you had with Stephen about this, and I have to say that of the samples that I got of the track list, I got some really, what I think are good questions. So let's start with the big picture and then dial in.
Yeah, I was very excited to be a part of this show. My agent Jeff came in and was saying, they're remaking Queer as Folk. We have to get you in front of them. And the team behind Queer as Folk made a very conscious effort to hire queer writers, queer actors, a queer composer, me. That was very important to them to make the story feel as authentic as possible. And I commend them for doing that because I think it is important. And I think that is how you're going to get the most honest representation of a show like this. It was kind of a lengthy process of kind of going back and forth, reading scripts, having conversations with Stephen and the producers, down to doing a pitch of a musical idea that could serve as a representation of what could be done for the show. And ultimately he liked my previous music, liked the demo, liked what I had to say, I think we just as people gelled in a nice way. And that was like something I noticed very quickly the moment I started having conversations. You could just feel this sense of community and love between these people that it was infectious, and you like it felt like a family to be a part of, because it really just everyone was there wanting to give it their all and pour their love into making the best show that represents that, what something that we could all see ourselves in, and recognize kind of the importance of that and wanting to give it the best we could.
Well, let's talk about that demo, because I think it is important what you said about the crew being like-minded and having the experiences that join them together and things that everybody can understand and relate to while they're working. How integral was the demo at that point? Was it an interview process, or like, can go back to that point?
Yeah, so I had sent kind of like a slew of music from previous projects, and he had gravitated towards this score they had done for a podcast called American Coyote through Imperative Entertainment. And I mean, the entire score was essentially built from me banging pieces of metal together. I recognized early on, he really liked percussion. He really liked kind of a more unusual found sound feel, and things that felt unconventional. And so that played a key role in that. He then sent me the script, which I read through and was floored by, and we had a conversation about the script. And then from there, kind of wrote a demo inspired by the script itself. And then I got the call from my agent that they hired me, or wanted to hire me.
So. Well, that's phenomenal. Do you have a kind of a goofy question? Do you have a victory dance for getting a job and finishing a job? Like, how do you celebrate in either aspect?
I have a martini.
Very sophisticated.
I have a martini and cheers. I go, all right, I'm going to go disappear into a studio for a long time. So like, go out, martini, go out, have a dinner, and then understand that life is going to be inside my cave for a little while.
Won't be around for a while.
Yeah.
Don't send the police.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I have to say that listening to the music, you definitely get, it's very, sounds very tribal, sounds very fit for the club. But there's one track that really gets to me, and I'm assuming this is not the entire, the culmination of the work that you've done, but I could just live in a track called Gone. It's 3 minutes of just emotional and emotive and just really, I mean, to say it might be the heart of the music might be an overstatement, because I don't know what went into it, but I loved it. And from the first couple seconds, I was entranced. So what went into that? How did you come up with that? How did that response.
Well, thank you. I think what was exciting about this show was just the clear kind of diversity that was going to be involved musically in this show. You were going to have the kind of chaotic, messy, percussive sound, and then there was going to be a lot of these very emotional moments to hit the audience with. And so for that track, it's something that plays at the end of episode one, in which there was a shooting at a club. And it's kind of, it's what brings all of our characters together. And it, up until then, it was kind of fun and sexy and messy. And then you kind of get hit with a sense of reality in that moment. And so that was an interesting track to write, in the sense that I'm singing all over it, and I'm not a singer, even though I like may have like done operas when I was like really young. It was just changed dramatically since then. But there was a weird sense of discovery that happened with that, where I was late at night, and I wanted to put vocals in there. I wasn't going to hire a vocalist at midnight when I needed to send the cue the next morning. So I just kind of laid down some vocals, and Stephen Dunn really loved it. And he really loves the vocal aspect of it. And it ended up, there ended up being a lot more vocals throughout the rest of the score. But I, as someone who's gay, your voice is kind of it's a struggle, I think, growing up at times. At least for me personally, it's kind of the thing that gives you away. A lot of times people are like, your voice sounds gay. You're more feminine, your voice is higher. And that's something that goes down to even just answering a phone and someone referring to you as madam, and then you correct them as a sir and things like that. And so I've always been quite self-conscious about just the sound of my voice in general. And so to do something and then have someone just say how much they love it, it kind of gave this boost of confidence in myself to see that as, oh, here's another option I can do musically. And I was in a space where people could relate to that. People could understand that, like, we all have this sense of insecurity being gay, queer, whatnot. We all have gone through some sort of struggle generally to do that. And so to have something like that happen on a very unapologetically queer show was a surprising thing for me. And it was, so that track has a lot of meaning just to me personally, having written it.
I'm glad you told me all that. I really applaud you for being able to put into words how you felt, but also like make it like a meaningful to you. Because I think that sometimes a lot of, you know, when somebody puts anything out there creatively, a drawing, a painting, planting a flower or something like that, it just takes a lot to get it out in there in the world. And so I could see how well you would have appreciated that someone else appreciated it. So golf claps.
Thanks.
but more to that, you mentioned something I was going to pick up on, or I had picked up on. There's a lot more voice work and choral elements as the show goes on, and it's kind of a mix of, when I say tribal, it felt like Carnival. There's just like a lot of energy, and especially the end credit track, which is I imagine built on things that, you know, throughout the season and just, or extrapolated. But the voices are so, like, to say chirping just sounds dumb, but it's just like there's a lot. So with respect to budgets and time and things like that, are you using real people? Is there a way to synthesize or do soundboards of choral? How does that work?
Yeah, so that was me again. That was vocals. Okay. It was, and you could go affect the vocals too to kind of give it a more synthetic effect. The vocals themselves, actually, there's like a repeated pattern that goes cat, cat. And that is inspired by ballroom-esque music, which in kind of queer culture is the like the voguing, the drag queens, like that experience. And so that was a nod to that. And that track itself was kind of a nod to that that feeling, which is kind of just energetic and loud and, you know, and just fun in that regard. And so, I mean, that track was just built off of anything and that, and everything. I mean, you had the sound of like street buckets inspired by street performers in New Orleans where the show takes place. You had the sound of heels clacking across the floor. You had the sound of sex toys hitting a drum. You had the sound of someone vomiting, which was used as a splash symbol. you had the sound of like bicycle wheels spinning. You had Mardi Gras beads shaking, clanking of beer bottles, blowing into wine glasses, wine bottles, sorry. Claps, snaps, weird vocal breaths, anything not normally looked at as an instrument.
So you rattled off more than half a dozen unique and very specific, you know, geographic, we'll call it indigenous references. At what point did you just go, this is too much, or hey, not enough? Let's just, you know, with Steven, like, hey, bring it, this needs it.
Well, I think just early conversations with Steven about how he just wanted something unique and found sound feel. I mean, that was terrifying and exciting to hear because it really just meant nothing was off the table. So it just took some time to really just try different things and see, because at that point you're not really saying, hey, here is a theme. Do you like the theme? It's, it could be down to the minute, like, do you even like, do you like this sound? Which is like, this theme is built off of these weird sounds. Like, is it these sounds that aren't resonating and things like that. And so it was definitely like an exploration of like what could be the show. And it was really just taking inspiration from what was already on the screen. I mean, you know, when you're seeing a bunch of drunk people on the street of New Orleans and things, I was like puking, someone's throwing up. That's gonna be a crash symbol, let's do it. You know, I took like a cocktail rocks glass and rubbing it against an ice bucket and things like that. It was just like, you know, that he's, I mean, there's a main character who's named Mingus who rides a skateboard and is kind of a young drag queen. So I was like, well, let's match the two. We're gonna take the sounds of skateboards and the sound of heels clacking on the floor. Like it's, so it was, I mean, it was a lot of fun. It was just kind of going around and finding, collecting things in the house, buying things and trying it out. So yeah, I mean, but that's, to me, that's so exciting and why it was such a fun project to be a part of, because I can't say I've used sex toys on a drum or an instrument in another project before, but now I have.
And he will not disclose what specific types or name brands of those sex toys, but family show. Well, I mean, that's awesome because I think that that stretches your wings as or stretches your muscles as a sound engineer, because not only are you trying to rhythmically do things, it's like, I mean, you're almost getting into Foley at that point, you know, something that makes you feel immersed in the world, not just giving you something to put your headphones on and listen to. So just gets people more involved. That's excellent.
Yeah.
Well, I really like Take Back Control. Can you talk about that track? I mean, when do the names come in? Because I've always heard things like 2M5 and 7M22. Like, when do the names get into the track?
I mean, honestly, the names just come from our music editor, Rhianne DeClercq, who was amazing on the show. And she, it's just a form of organization when you're on each. Yes, you would have like 2M04, 2M05, but then you could have the title there. So like you could quickly call on a cue and go, oh yes, I know what that's about. So with something like Take Back Control, that's when one of our main characters, Brody, is going through reliving kind of a traumatic, like having a panic attack based off of the shooting that happened at the club. It's in episode 3. And he is grappling with how to find joy beyond amongst that. And then also, you know, struggling to find ways to bring his community together. And so it kind of goes through a whole range of emotions from that initial panic attack to something that's very emotional and personal to him, to then this feeling of, no, we're gonna find another way. And that's when it kind of picks up at the end with, yeah, some like deep pulsing stuff.
Well, so maybe speak to the consumers. Are you given any awareness of how the soundtrack will be released? Or, I mean, I got a sampling of maybe 10 tracks. How much more went into the show?
Yeah, it was kind of an episode-to-episode basis. There was actually a lot of music in the show. I mean, amongst just the score, there's amazing songs throughout. So, I mean, shout out to the music team that, like, was pulling some amazing music throughout the series, and then finding ways to have score live amongst that and still feel like it's like part of the same world. Peacock hopefully is looking into releasing a score soon. Those kind of things you can only, you know, say, but I want to do this. And, you know, you hope the studio's like, you obviously have to get the studio's approval and things like that. So we're still to be determined on that.
Gotcha. And that's the thing, as a consumer, I always find it funny. I've spoken to Steve Jablonski a long time ago, and I was like, but you wrote the music. It's your baby. Because like, I was commissioned. I don't own the music. Like, that wasn't the conversation, but it's like, it's unfortunate that, you know, like, just because you came out of you doesn't mean it belongs to you. So weird how the rights work, but is what
contracts.
It is. Well, why don't we wrap this up with what you're doing next? I do have another question about your creative process. Now that you get to you're paid to do the thing you love, do you still get into art? Do you still want to coach gymnastics on the side? How do you get away from the job? And is it possible?
I don't want to limit myself to anything when it comes to music. So I have a huge interest in theater and live performance. So I definitely would love to do some more live show type things. I'm a huge Cirque du Soleil fan. So would love to provide music for one of their shows at some point. During the pandemic, I wrote, 2 years ago now, however long it was, I wrote a piece of music and then, hired a bunch of dancers, and we did kind of like a short dance film called Hum. I just don't want to limit myself to just film and television. So anything that's creative that could be, a challenge musically, I am completely for. So, those doors are all open. I'm currently working on another nature animal series, and I have a docuseries that'll come out in a bit for Netflix. I'm working on a podcast on Elizabeth Taylor, and there's another animal show later too.
Two legs, four legs, six legs. I'm just joking. Yes.
I have a lot of animal shows I've done.
Well, Joshua, why don't you take us out of the interview? Tell us where people can find your stuff while we eagerly await your upcoming projects. Where do you have your streaming, your website? Let's give us some websites.
Yeah. I mean, I have my personal website, joshuacleavy.com. I have music up on Spotify, Apple Music, and all those usual things. There's the podcasts that are up there as well that has my music in it. There's a slew of documentaries all on Netflix to check out. That was another project. I'm going to be working on another documentary on Ukraine. I had done a documentary called Winter on Fire back in 2015. And obviously, given everything that's been going on in Ukraine, we're revisiting that with the same team. So that's a meaningful project I'm going to be a part of.
Great. We look forward to all that and more. And from everyone at Go See Talk, send a lot of love to Josh's way. Josh, you want to tell us one other thing that is on the horizon? 7 days from now, maybe? I can edit it out if you don't want
to. In Italy?
I'm sorry, I interrupted it. Please go ahead.
I am getting married in Italy, in Positano. to, yes, my fiance Evan. And yeah, that should be a nice break and exciting celebratory moment that has nothing to do with music, which is important.
Yet it'll be another reason why he's siloed for a brief period of time. So we wish you the very best. This has been a very delightful conversation. So we will catch you next time.